listeners, you're listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. On the show, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And today is our last episode of the season. So we're just going to talk about how this year was, what were some highlights, what are some things we learned about life and plays.
Or didn't learn.
Continue learning next year.
Yeah. So this year was a little different. We started a lot later.
Yeah. Why was that, Sarah? What happened to you in the spring?
Let's see. In spring, I gave a birth to a child, and that brought him into this wretched world.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was incredible. And then I almost died.
Oh my God.
So but that was my big highlights.
Yeah, you became a mother. Recall.
Yeah.
Do you think you've changed? Do you think Mom Sarah is a different person than you were before February?
In some ways, yes, in some ways no. I'll say this, that whenever I see a TV show now or a movie or like reading something about, you know, mother losing a child, anything like that, I go into like this, like, I don't spiral, but I just get into I get more emotional because I'm like, I cannot imagine. I just feel like becoming a mom, I just have this like this like really strong bond with my baby, right? So it's like anything happens to him or the idea of anything happening to him, I'm like, I'm not going to go there. I can't watch this. I'm not turning this off.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But now I don't dismiss it as I was like, oh yeah, the thing. Yeah. This mom, this character lost a child. Big deal. Now I'm like, oh, this is a very big deal and this should never happen.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess that's good because I don't think we would have survived very long as a species if mothers were just like, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Go jump off a wall.
Play with glass.
Yeah, go play with glass.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So Augie was born. Welcome to the world, Augie. What else happened this year?
Politically?
Oh my God, don't go there.
Any big highlights for you? What was some major highlights?
Well, I directed a show in the spring, but that was before our season even started. Because you guys, we were just looking back and we realized we started in June, so.
Yeah.
I worked on my play, 100 Circling Camps, over the summer at Middlebury College's new project, Dog Team Theater Project. So that was cool. And I'm working on a new draft of that right now. And I started my third year of my PhD program.
Has it really been?
Yeah.
Wow, you've been there for, this is your third year? Yeah. Wow.
And after this year, I have two more to go. Can you believe it?
Wow. 5 years? Wow.
Yep. So, but
do you think you could do it? Two more years?
I think I can do it. I mean, I'm done with my coursework. So the next 2 years, basically, I'm just writing my dissertation and teaching.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. Although because I'm me, I'm taking a class this semester, but I don't have to. I'm just doing it anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you guys, it's all paid for, exactly. I'm all funded.
Yeah.
But if you're thinking about getting a PhD, I ask you to really think hard about how you want to spend this one precious life that you have.
It's a commitment.
It's such a commitment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, I don't know. I mean, I think because I was already in my 30s when I started, mid-30s, just like it was a big mm-hmm. adjustment coming back to school and having people tell me what to do and assigning me homework.
Yeah, I think that's what I don't miss about graduate school. Yeah. It's like this being, yeah.
But I mean,
because right now I'm like, I can read whatever I want. So I'm like, right. Oh, at my own pace and my time. And then, yeah.
But I have read a lot of really cool things.
That's good.
So,
yeah.
I'm enjoying it, I think.
Nice.
For the most part. So maybe we should just highlight some of our episodes this season if anyone hasn't listened to all of them yet. For example, our second episode of the season was we read this play, Why Mary, which was the first play ever to win the Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. And very interesting play. Wouldn't you say?
Yes, it was very interesting. What do I remember about it? No, I remember thinking it was like, oh, it was like satirizing marriages at the time, because I think mm-hmm. I think it was like a lot of arranged marriages, or like, yeah, this idea of what a marriage. Yeah.
Yeah, it was this question of like, what obligation does a woman have to get married, and is it possible for her to have a career instead?
Mm-hmm.
And the really radical thing, if I remember correctly, was the idea that somebody could be married and also have a woman could be married and also have a career. That was like, what?
What? And have a baby? What? Yeah. So listeners, if you liked us reading the very first Pulitzer Prize winning play and you want us to keep going, slide into our DMs.
Yeah, let us know. We're always looking for Pulitzer Prize winning plays to read from the past. They don't have to have won a Pulitzer, but there's something interesting about that curation process where you get a sense of like what was on people's minds at the time, or what was the like hot button issue. We also had some great interviews this year.
Yes. We interviewed Jia Kim, who I met at Great Plains Theater Conference. She was my dramaturg, and what a delightful conversation that was. Really fun.
Amazing guest she was.
Yeah. That was like our first guest of the season. So mm-hmm. right off the gate, I was like, whoa, here we go. Standards are high. And it's getting higher. No, that was a really fun conversation. Yeah. Yeah, we had this season was very short, but I feel like there were like high quality episodes.
Exactly. Short and full of gems.
Yep.
And we kind of we had our first designer interview on the show with Alex Casillas, and we interviewed I don't know. I feel like we kind of branched out more among different kinds of areas that people work in the theater. So that was cool.
Yeah. I would love – well, here's a goal maybe for our next future episode is I would love to interview like stage manager and
–
like that, you know, the backstage. You know, all the people that actually work their butt off to make it all happen. Yeah.
Technical director.
And also like projection designer. I would love to interview them. So if you're a projection designer out there, reach out.
Reach out.
Come on
us.
Board.
Yeah. Is there anything you feel like you learned from this season, either from our episodes that we did or just from life?
Just from life. This is a very reflective year for sure. Well, one thing I know is life is very precious. Whether like you're bringing life into the world or you're about to lose it, Oh, oh boy.
Gosh. Yeah. I really did have like a near-death experience.
Yeah, it was very terrifying. This year, I think I learned about how the strength of the body, like, mm-hmm. you know, and then also just how quickly it could be the weakest, like, be weak mm-hmm. and frail. Like, I just learned, like, right now, I think more than ever, I just feel so, like, conscious about like what I eat and you know mm-hmm. how to take care of myself and making sure I'm like staying active and what I'm putting into my body, and you know it's just like I'm becoming more like careful and not like mindless like, oh, this is good, I'll eat it, but I'm like, why am I eating this, what's in this
mm-hmm.
Because I just really I think when I take care of myself physically, then I think it'll also affect me emotionally and mentally too. And so this year was it's so crazy too how I thought that becoming a mom, I thought it was also like, oh, it's gonna, a lot of things is just gonna be over for me, like, oh, I'm not gonna do comedy anymore, I'm not gonna do writing anymore, I'm just not gonna do anything. I just really, like, while I was pregnant, I think I was just like all my hormones were so out of place and I was a little more like depressed than usual, more than usual, and I really thought my life is over, and it just feels like, oh, it's just getting started.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it feels like. Becoming a mom just feels like a whole new chapter, and I'm learning a lot as I go. So,
that's
it feels
beautiful.
Like, yeah. Not really about play rating, but.
But I feel like when you're like 60, you're gonna be looking back and thinking, wow, the thought that when I was in my 30s I thought my life was over is hilarious.
Yeah. What about you? Anything in life?
I did my comprehensive exams this year, which meant that over the summer, I had to read a list of 60 texts, books, plays, articles.
Yeah.
And then I wrote 3 essays in the fall. The first 10 days of, or I guess it was the second week of the semester. And I really learned, I mean, this is, I know I was just saying, like, don't get a PhD unless you really want it. But there is something about that process of, like, reading kind of a broad swath of writing in an area of study and then synthesizing it, that really, I just got a lot out of that process. It helped me kind of make connections in my thinking. And this is something I feel like I have to learn over and over again, but it really reminded me that writing and the writing process is a way of thinking, and that when you write a paper in which you're kind of pulling together all these different areas of thought, you're actually able to think, to think more deeply in a way that when you just kind of try to work on the ideas in your mind, it's much, much harder to get as far. And I was thinking about this specifically too with, I read this book called Mind in Motion. That was one of my books on my list, which is by a psychologist, and she's really interested in how physical movement underlies and also extends the thinking process. And so she looks at like how gestures can help us think. And she says something in that book, her name is Barbara Tversky, and she says something about how when we run or push a box or something, when we when we have physical actions that change the physical world or a place in the world, it's really apparent how, like if you run from one place to another, you're changing your position in the world. And so it's clear how that physical action is changing things for you. But in the same way, when you gesture, you're actually shaping your thought or somebody else's thought. So it's like physical action on thinking, on thoughts, which is something that's not physical. And so it can make the thinking process easier. And in the same way, when you write or when you use a tool, like you're sketching something or even using a calculator or something, an external tool like a calculator or writing can actually allow you to think in ways that are not possible without that tool. Like you can just go so much further in your thought. And yeah, and so I've just been thinking about this a lot, that like a lot of times when I'm trying to figure out an idea, I think I can just solve it in my mind before I start writing, and that's actually not the case. It's actually the writing that helps me think.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that's I would say that's something I've learned, but it's like something I have to learn over and over and over again.
Yeah.
In the same way that when I'm writing a play, if I think I'm going to figure the play out before I start writing, then I'm usually wrong. I have to start writing what the characters are saying to each other in order to understand who those characters are and what the situation is. So it's like this feedback loop. Like I'm not somebody who can just figure out a whole play and then write it down. What about you?
What you mean in terms of like
when you're writing a play, yeah. Do you feel like you figure out what's going to happen before you start writing?
No. Well, I think I do. But then once I start writing and it changes.
Yeah.
Because I think when I – yeah, I think there's something about when you're writing and you're like writing one line after the other – the actions after the other, you're like, wait, this has to make sense. There's some logic has to be made here. And so when I think about it before writing it, I'm thinking more broadly. I'm thinking more just like I'm not really getting into the nitty-gritty of it when I'm actually start writing it. Yeah, so I think
Yeah, I remember – I wish I could remember who said this, but I remember reading one time – somebody saying the play you write is never going to match the play that was in your mind, but that's because the thing that was in your mind was not a play. You know,
it
was
an idea
for a play, and that's not the same thing.
Right. Yeah. So one of the plays I'm working on right now is based on something that happened when I was in high school. Like it's just like really short story. Like it's just something that's happened, but and it's a play I'm writing about inspired by that. And the play is like it has all these characters that doesn't really exist. You know, it has it's a world that kind of resembles what the experience was like, but I'm like it's something entirely new and different. Like there's a nugget of idea of experience in there, but as you're writing it, because and you know it needs to be like 90 minutes of theatrical experience, like
right,
this experience that happened to me one time in high school, that's like a blip. How do I extrapolate that and make that interesting, because other people will be like, well, that's not interesting. So I have to figure it out how to make it interesting.
Yeah, I definitely feel that.
Yeah.
You have to make it into a satisfying story.
Exactly.
Which is why, you know, sometimes I've been in writing workshops or when I was teaching writing, particularly fiction. You know, sometimes people would write stories based on things in their real life, that had really happened to them. And then in the workshop process, someone would say, you know, would ask a question or would say, you know, I think it might work better like this. And then the writer would say, yeah, but that's how it really happened. And would find it difficult to kind of break free of the way events had actually played out. And I've experienced this too, working on my play about the Bonus Army March, which is like when you're writing something about a historical event, how do you balance being true to the facts and also making, a story that would that will be satisfying and compelling over 90 minutes?
Oh, this is a reminder me of something that happened a few weeks ago about, do you know this comedian Hasan Minhaj?
I've heard the name, but I've never seen him perform.
So he's this comedian, and I guess his recent special, he fabricated a lot of his stories. And New Yorker talked about, like, he lied. Like, basically saying he lied. And then Hasan Minhaj responded to that New Yorker writer being like, it's a performance. Like, it's a comedy. Yeah. You know, it's like – but then I kept thinking about this idea of truth because especially comedians, like – a lot of them are talking from their own experience or telling something, a story that happened to them. And we laugh when they were like, how honest and truthful sometimes it sounds, you know, or it is.
Right.
Because we like resonate. Oh, like that's hilarious. Or like, whoa, that's shocking. Or like, you know, we're like, and a lot of people, I just think that, you know, it was, they look at stand-up comedy too, like comedians being like, oh, they're kind of like today's philosophers or like the today's seers or whatever. But then, and then so I just like think about the kind of like the obligation, like how much truth can we tell? How much can we, do we not tell, you know, as creatives and writers? And I just feel like, I don't know, comedy, maybe stand-up comedy is like a whole different thing because they are playing themselves or a version of themselves on stage that – and their observations, so and their point of view, so it just feels so it has to be true and honest,
right? Yeah, it's like part of what makes it work, is that assumption that what they're saying really happened,
right? Yeah, so that's what I've been thinking a lot about as a writer. I was like, well, how much. I mean, obviously, playwriting, it's storytelling, or what you but what you said is like if a historical event, something that happened. Like how much do you use or stay true to the source and how much do you, can you, you know, have the freedom to sort of fabricate and to, because it has to make sense for the audience. Like it has to, like,
And where's the line? I mean, I feel like there's a whole spectrum of like even just rearranging events, putting one earlier than one that it actually happened after. Yeah. Like, is that lying?
Yeah. And I was like thinking a lot about what Sherry Kramer said. Who was on the show?
Go back and listen to that episode.
Yeah. And I just think about the first few pages, how she said that it like sets up the expectation like for the audience, like what the rest is of the play is going to be like. It's like really setting up those. She has a very specific saying about it. But I think that's another thing too, is like how much, if depending on how much truth you want to tell or how much you want to fabricate, it's like make those like first few pages that expectation, like, you know, I'm going to get a little magical realism here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And whether you like it, you know, it's like whether it's true or not, but it's like, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of it.
I think about this all the time with, I never really got into Game of Thrones, but I do remember in the first couple pages of the book and also in the first couple minutes of the very first episode of the show, you get introduced to these characters and you like learn about them. I don't even remember the specifics, but then very quickly they die. And I feel like that is such a good example of setting up an audience to expect the way this world is going to work, which is that you're going to meet all these characters and then many of them are going to suddenly die. And I never really ended up watching that show, but from what I've heard, a lot of people die in Game of Thrones.
Yeah. So you watched the first 3-4 episodes.
Yeah. And then I was like, I don't like this. I don't know. It was so violent. It was like
violent. Incest.
I don't even know if I even got to the incest. Maybe I got like a glimpse of it, but it was. Yeah. Remember, it was. I want to say that was like before the Me Too movement. And I remember all these conversations about all the gratuitous, like all the women for some reason just were always naked. And I was like, why is this? Like, what is this world where, like, you know, and there were a lot of sex scenes, but they were the male gaze was just so aggressive.
Yeah, for sure the first seasons. But the later seasons, it's like Dany, the queen of dragons. Like,
she just, I like, know, I remember.
And I'm just like, that. Oh yeah. My god, it's the coolest thing ever. Oh my god, those things are freaking, yeah.
All right, maybe I'll watch it.
Yeah, it is, and it is very, like, male in terms of like the competition, right? It's like, who's gonna be the next, you know, like the king? Game of Thrones is all this competitive competition that happens, and it's very like mind fuck in the gaming that people that they're playing, the games, the mind games that they all play. But I just remember the towards the end, it was like such a epic. It was just, it gets really epic towards the end.
Doesn't that just feel like it was another time? It was like, that feels so long ago.
I think the season ended, the series ended like the year before the pandemic started. Like, it was like,
yeah, I'm looking now, 2011 to 2019.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Crazy. Well, I guess one question I have for you, Sam, is, what are you looking forward to in the new year?
Oh, anything good question.
Exciting?
I am looking forward to getting more sleep and eating more vegetables. I feel like I had the opposite experience of you. You were talking about how you've gotten like so much more thoughtful about putting what you put into your body and like taking care of yourself. I have gone way too far in the other direction, which is like taking on too many projects, really diving deep into my work in preparing for my dissertation. And whereas in the past I have been pretty good about like getting enough sleep and eating well, I feel like the past few months I've been like, oh, I can get by on eating like crackers and peanut butter. Oh, I can get by on like only getting a few hours of sleep. And the truth is I can't, but I've been kind of deluding myself. Yeah. So I need to rebalance in the other direction. Maybe I should have a baby. That's what I'm hearing from you.
As no, well. No.
Way to arrive at that.
You will definitely lose sleep. You'll be in the negative, and there's no way to catch up. You're just like in debt for sleep. So there's no way of getting out of it. But
what are you looking forward to?
Oh, let's see. In terms of playwriting, so I'm working on, this is crazy, but I'm like writing two plays at the same time.
Wow.
But so I think in the new year I'm really excited, just like what's gonna come up, like the finished draft of it all, and I'm really looking forward to that and having there'll be a reading for it, and that's what I'm excited about. I'm also teaching in the spring.
Oh, cool.
Modern drama. I didn't mention on the show, but I was teaching intro to theater this past fall, and then I'll be teaching modern drama in the spring. Do you hear the crying? You can hear? They just got home from a walk, so I think that means we're wrapping up here.
Should we go to Glistens?
Yeah, we'll move on to Glistens. Let's see. Do you want to go first?
Sure. My Glisten is an article I read a few months ago that I've been thinking about for ever since. Which is, it was in the New Yorker, I think it was in September, and it's by Elizabeth Colbert, and the title is Can We Talk to Whales? And it's about how scientists are using AI, specifically large language models, such as ChatGPT, but it's like a different version of that. But it's the same idea to try to figure out how to communicate with whales. And the way it works is they have all of these, you know, tens of thousands of hours of recordings of whale language. And I think specifically they're interested in sperm whales in this study, but there are, I think, similar ones happening elsewhere. And they input all of this recorded language, whale language, into this large language model, which then can, just like ChatGPT does, predict the next most likely thing a whale would say, and then in theory say that to the whales. And so I mean, it's a really good article. It's super interesting. The thing that I keep thinking about is, like, presumably once this is actually communicating with the whales, and mostly they communicating in these codas, which are made up of clicks. And so they're kind of rhythmic clicks that mean different things. Many of these groups of sperm whales use codas to identify what group they're part of or identify individuals. But there's a lot of the communication that we just don't understand what it means. But in theory, this AI could start generating, using this predictive technology, could generate language to speak to the whales and have a whole conversation with the whales, and we would not know what they're saying, which is so interesting to me that, you know, it's this technology we've created, but it could start talking in this way that we can't understand.
Wow.
What was that sound?
What?
Oh, I heard this, like, slapping sound.
Oh, I was trying to get this bug. I didn't think you could hear me, but I guess you did.
What's your glisten, Sarah?
I was trying to, like, gently slap.
It was so loud.
Sorry. Oh, hilarious. I will make sure to get that audio out. Let's see. My glisten is I watched the season of, I caught up on the season of this year's season of MasterChef. This year it was, each region was competing. So it was like West Coast, South, Northeast, and Midwest. Okay. And all a group of people competing. And at the end of the competition, Midwest wins. Kind of spoiler. Bummed. Yeah. You guys aren't watching it. I know you're not watching it. I was kind of surprised because I thought the Midwest chef was all I can remember from those dishes was just like pork and beer. Like that's, sounds like Midwest. And the West
Coast. That's a crowd pleaser though.
It is. And yeah, so it was a kind of simple, but not, I mean, there was some complexity, but it was like kind of simple, but, and it was up against, the Midwest went up against the West Coast and South. And then I thought the West and the South did like beautiful, like, plating, and like it looked fabulous and stuff, but at the end of the Midwest one, and I was like, maybe the world is trying to tell me to move to the Midwest or something.
Yeah, I think that is what it's telling you. I mean, the thing is, you can have lots of beautiful presentation, but if the flavor is not there, then
yeah,
I just think the flavor is gonna win every time.
Yeah, I mean, all those dishes looked good. I was just like, I think there's just something about keeping it simple.
Yeah,
and like, and having like, oh, few ingredients and just letting those few ingredients shine,
yeah,
is more impactful than trying to, you know, mix and try to like experiment with different things. So I don't know. Life lesson there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that also seems to kind of sum up the difference between the Midwest and the West Coast, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. The person from the West Coast was actually from Colorado.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and she, or no, I think they're they. The pronoun is they. they made it clear. They use all these like the inspiration was all like the wilderness of Colorado. It was like so cool. Like the That's first cool. appetizer was like they made it like a plating that looked so beautiful, like looked like a little trout swimming and like the you know, like it just gorgeous. I was like, oh my gosh, I wanna eat that so badly. But
did that make you want to move to Colorado?
Not quite, because their second dish was rabbit, and I don't like game. Like I don't like gamey meat. But their second dish was rabbit, and I heard as a rabbit is very difficult to cook, and so that was
I've never eaten rabbit.
Yeah, there's no fat on it, is what they said. So it's like really hard to cook.
Wow.
You could easily dry it out or like overcook it. And then also like you don't want to over season rabbit because of the lack of fat. It could really just, so it's really hard, but.
You know, maybe, I mean, this is all making me think maybe somewhere down the line in our future, we should just have a cooking podcast.
Oh, heck yes.
Well, listeners, thank you so much for listening to our season finale. And if you missed an episode this season, go back and listen. It was a good season.
Yeah. Short but sweet. Short
and sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.